Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Destruction, Reconstruction, and Displacement Politics in Syria. I'm delighted to introduce our speaker for today, Ammar Azouz, who is a British Academy Research Fellow at University of Oxford. He is the author of Domicide, Architecture, War, and the Destruction of a Home in Syria, which was published by Bloomsbury. He has also written for a wide range of platforms, including the New York Times, the Financial Times, and the Guardian. Welcome to the podcast, Ammar.
Thank you so much for having me, Romola.
So I've been really excited to have you on this podcast, and I've been really looking forward to talking to you about your work. And you've done this fantastic work looking at these questions of domicide and so forth. And at this present moment, we are looking again at Syria now that the regime has fallen, and many people are thinking also about reconstruction. But one of the things that we were talking about is also that there's this longer history of violence and struggle that existed well before the civil war. And this also links into the war and into this post-war moment. So I just was wondering, as a way of starting this conversation, if you wanted to talk to us very briefly through this history, please.
Thank you so much, Romola, for having me in your podcast. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity. So I work on the questions of destruction of cities. And as we are all aware of, we are living in a time where one city after the other is being destroyed, from Palestine and Sudan to Ukraine and Syria and many, many other places. Whilst we always see the images of destruction in the news when wars and occupations and dictators have their fire and battles on civilians and on their cities, we tend to forget that slow violence happens even before these images of destruction in quote-unquote peacetime situations. So in my city, Homs, the third largest city in Syria that I focus on in my research, I try to make an argument that even though the city has been heavily destroyed during the time of the war, but many of its destruction has also happened before 2011, which means that the city was already built on infrastructure of segregation, divisions, social exclusion, and also on a landscape of silence. People everywhere in the city said that walls have ears, and nobody was able to protest or to even like grieve publicly if they have had a family member who was forcibly disappeared, which was the case in many times in Syria. So we lived in this kingdom of fear that the city has become the site of grief and misery, but also the site of silence and absence. So in addition to living in this space of silence and feeling almost marginalized in our own cities and exiled in our own cities, we have also witnessed the violence in regards to destruction of the material culture. So for instance, in the old city in Homs, much of its cultural heritage sites have been knocked down from the 70s actually, and the 90s and early 2000s, in the name of urban regeneration or urban development, to lay the foundation for new administrative buildings that really has caused a huge damage to the identity and the sense of belonging in the city.
I just wanted to of pick up on one of the points that you were sort of closing with, which is kind of looking at that urban regeneration kind of discussion and the destruction of the city. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how these kinds of questions around regeneration and particularly the housing, land, and property questions were weaponized also during the war, and how that also leads to the displacements of people, right? And multiple displacements of them, presumably. You've got a war, a civil war going on, and then you've got the government also pursuing these quite aggressive urban regeneration agendas simultaneously and also in tandem with each other. So I wanted to ask you to talk us through some of that as well.
Yeah, so the housing, land, and property rights, HLB rights, have been weaponized in many different ways in Syria. I will just give one example before the war and then move us through how it turned into during the time of the war. So before the revolution started in 2011, as part of the wider protest in the Arab region that we all know as the Arab Spring, Rabi' al-Arabi, we have seen a project in Homs that was called the Homs Dream. Envisioned by the mayor at the time in around 2000, that was the time when the project was announced. And at that period of time, the project called for the destruction of the city center to build the modern heart of the city. But also, it started forcibly displacing people from their own orchards and lands to lay the foundation for this new project. So there was already a way that HLP rights have been weaponized. Now, after 2011, the line between, conflict and peace and war and peace becomes very blurred, because after 2011, these HLB rights have been also weaponized, but in more intense and more brutal way. So I will just give a few examples on how that happened. For instance, one example is about the destruction of the places where the HLB rights documentations have been stored. So we have seen in my city, Homs, and actually in the first page of my book, Domicide, I start this scene where this building, where it's these documents are collected, is targeted deliberately, and there's fire in it. And whilst the government said that was an accident, or it was quote unquote the terrorist who targeted it, many activists have been accusing the government of using this as a tool, as a weapon, to punish people who oppose the government in Homs. But also to erase the evidence that people who live in the city have HLP rights. So that was, on one hand, an example of the weaponization of these rights. But on the other hand, you have the mass destruction of the cities. So in Homs, that became to be known as the capital of the revolution because of the rebellion and the protests and the continuity and the intensity of the protests inside the city. It was really punished by the destruction of the architecture, by making the place uninhabitable, and therefore we call this word domicide. It's really about making the place uninhabitable for the people, and that's why we see not only that people are killed or forcibly disappeared, but their places, their architecture, their everyday life is erased. And also for those who survive, the question of return becomes very complex and difficult if they have lost the access to their documents that have been burnt, or in some cases where I documented in my book, have been flooded in other towns and cities to really target people's evidence of living there. There are many ways that, architecture has been weaponized. For instance, another example is the government issuing, at the time of the conflict, they started issuing new urban planning decrees and laws to label certain neighborhoods as, between brackets, illegal or informal. And therefore, they started going to places like an area in the city of Hama called Masha' al-Arba'in, and they completely wiped out. Like, they haven't left any single building in an entire neighborhood, not for military purposes, but just because they called it like informal neighborhood. And this was at a time where people were already displaced. One out of two people in Syria have been displaced in the last 14 years. And it was in a time where people are really struggling to have access to their daily bread. So it was a striking evidence that the government has used architecture and its destruction as a weapon of the war.
So presumably these areas were targeted because they were the opposition areas, based on what you were talking about. And I was wondering if you could just talk about what was going on with different settlements, based on their political allegiances.
Yeah, so the government in Syria, the Assad regime, has labeled almost everyone that opposed them as a terrorist, and they led this campaign of the war on terror, but it really meant that killing every peaceful voice or imprisoning every peaceful voice that was opposing the government or punishing them. And part of that campaign of violence and collective punishment of people who opposed the government was to erase their places. And when they started bombing and bulldozing places where rebels have been staying in certain neighborhoods, they started also targeting other neighborhoods that there were no rebels at all. But people inside these neighborhoods were sympathetic with the revolution, and they were witnessing also massive protests of anti-government marches there. So we started seeing that the government, the Assad government, issued these laws to really collectively punish these people and start completely erasing their places. And in other areas where you have the same label of how they termed it as like an informal neighborhood, but because they were like inhabited by loyalists of the government, they were kept intact. So the law was selectively targeting certain areas, especially those who are opposing the government.
I was wondering if you could just again talk about what this means in this present moment. Who are the different players who are involved in, for example, the politics of sort of reconstruction and housing, land, and property issues now, and these questions around displacement of people? And I guess the other thing that I'd be really interested in asking you is what the impacts have been on the lives of people themselves.
So we are absolutely standing on the crossroad of many different roads that we can take in the future for Syria, but at least we feel, and many people feel, that there are roads to be taken before we felt like we are chained in somehow, or we couldn't even dare to walk on a road because we were blocked, from moving forward through living under dictatorship that led the country for over half a century, by the latest president that fled to Moscow in December 2024, Bashar al-Assad, but also before that, his father, Hafez al-Assad. So we suddenly wake up one day and we find that this kingdom of fear that I mentioned and I referred to as has collapsed, and this dictatorship has ended, and that exile has ended. So since 2011 until now, more than 14 million Syrians have been displaced. So one of the very big questions that we face now is about return. And reading what the UN has documented in the last 6, 7 months, I have seen that more than 1,400,000 Syrians have been able to return home, either those who have been internally displaced inside the country, or those who have fled outside the country. So the figure that I mentioned includes 400,000 people who came back from neighboring countries and 1 million people who were displaced inside Syria. And of course, like one of the other big questions, like that is linked to the question of return, it's about the question of rebuilding trust. We are still living in a place where trust is broken. Syria has witnessed a war that many external partners have been engaged, such as Russia, Iran, and Lebanon, and Turkey. But also at the same time, it's mostly an internal war, which means that if somebody is working at the university, maybe their colleague has been the reason for the disappearance of a student, or the imprisonment, or the killing of another person. So, how do we rebuild that social contract, and how do we rebuild the trust in a divided city and a divided community? I think the biggest answer would be to work on the question of transitional justice and accountability, because without that, we might end up in waiting for another war yet to come. But also, we might end up in new cycles of violence if people did not see there is justice, that it's been taken seriously and formally from the government, then perhaps, and I truly pray that wouldn't be the case, but more a revenge killing would happen by people if they did not see that anyone is taking their pain and suffering seriously. Now, all these questions of justice, accountability, return, are all linked to the space, and spatial questions are being raised about the future of the city and reconstruction. In my city, Homs, when I returned in 2025 for the first time after more than 13 years of forced displacement, I have seen that even though the war, the battles in Homs have ended a few years ago, actually, before the collapse of the Assad regime, there is absence of any reconstruction project because of many reasons. Of course, Syria has been under sanctions, financial sanctions, and it has been politically isolated. And also the economy is collapsed. You know, it's the country is exhausted by the war, and 9 out of 10 people live in extreme poverty. So now there are new channels of hope, and reconstruction should be definitely linked to the questions of politics and economy. And there are many opportunities to start thinking about reconstruction. And I have been also witnessing the different parties and organizations that they are interested in making that happen. So, for instance, we can think of the international organizations that already have been functioning during the years of the war, but with limited resources, such as the UN agencies. And you have also like local charities that are flourishing and working on the ground, and local architects who are interested in shaping the future of their city. But also you have gigantic companies coming from the Gulf countries, and also from Turkey, to come and say, ah, we want to come and help. But many times we have seen in the wars before, in different parts of the world, the reconstruction could also be seen as an investment opportunity for people who have not witnessed or felt or supported people who are in dire need. And there are also fears that the reconstruction could be violent and destructive if it really focuses on economic opportunities and investment, especially for foreign companies, let's say, rather than centralizing the voices and the suffering of the people. So we are really in a very difficult time. We live in this moment of radical hope, I would imagine, but it's a very fragile state emerging from over a half a century of dictatorship. So the movement is quite slow, but the country needs everyone, and there's a huge appetite for supporting the future of our country.
I just wanted to build on that question of trust a little bit and just ask you again how you feel these questions of memory and trauma play a role in the reconstruction process itself and the rebuilding process, particularly of neighborhoods and communities.
Yeah, I think when I went to Syria and presented to an audience of over 100 people at the University of Damascus, I was criticized by one academic who said that my presentation seemed poetic and it comes from somebody who's nostalgic to his country. That's how I was described. And also the person was responding to my call for protecting the sites of trauma and suffering in the city as part of our future healing and our current healing and process of recovery. And he said, who cares about preserving a prison or a site of massacre or trauma? And I gave him an example to this academic in Damascus, and I told him that after the collapse of the Assad in one of the most notorious prisons, a group of young volunteers went there without any permission, and they started painting the cells of the prison with white paint. And for them, it was the message to turn darkness into light and moving on. But there was an outrage across the country that this act has been also a razor of a destruction of the evidence of what happened inside these torture cells. And also, it removes the evidence of what happened inside these cells. Because if we have seen the documentaries about the prisons in Syria, we see that many sites have like diaries or like signatures or memories or imprisoned people counting the days there if they had like a tiny sharp needle or a pen or something. So the question of memory and remembering is so crucial, and I think that's what I responded to the academic, and there was absolute silence in support to the argument I made. And of course, I think sometimes these questions might sound luxurious for people who might be struggling with their daily bread and daily life, and I understand that, and I understand the suffering that I have witnessed inside Syria. But at the same time, I have seen the call for from many Syrian activists and civil society organizations who want us to preserve the memory that we can call as dark heritage or the dark past of Syria, as a way that we can move forward in our quest for justice and transitional justice. Now, in addition to preserving the memory of the war itself, that I think we can also remember other places where the memory of war has been preserved. For instance, in Berlin, when the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, there was this call for erasing it and moving forward and removing what was called as the Wall of Shame. But then almost a few years later, when it was almost completely disappearing, there was another call to preserve whatever remains of it. And because people said this is part of our identity and part of the story of Berlin. Now, all the questions we need to think about it today in Syria before we run into the mad rush. And I'm really fearful that a lot of what happened in the war could be erased very quickly in this desire to move on. But I personally think we have a huge opportunity to show the next generations and to show the, you know, to show ourselves what happened, because many people who were under siege or who were, let's say, living in different cities did not know what happened in other cities such as Idlib or Raqqa or Deir Ezzor or Homs. So when they come and visit, there should be some sites to show what happened. Now, on a different point about memory, I think reconstruction could be destructive in the name of modernization and development. And we have seen that in the case of Beirut in Lebanon in the 90s with the Solidaire project that caused a huge destruction, and people were feeling alienated, uprooted, and actually a lot of people were displaced in the name of reconstruction. And now, when I see the project that they have been proposed in Syria, there's a project called Maruta City in Damascus that did huge destruction of green areas in the time of the Assad, and now it's still continuing after Assad time. They displaced people, they are building tower blocks for the rich and the elite. And now a new proposal comes a few months ago, actually 2 months ago, in Homs called the Victory Boulevard. And people just woke up one day and they saw this new development on the posters in the city. Nobody has consulted them. It's on the land that was forcibly taken from their people from their owners before the war started. So I'm really afraid of what scholars such as Muna Abaza call Dubaization. I'm really afraid from using these models, even if people have, between quotes, like good intentions, that they might come with violent visions that really look down at our identity and our society and say, oh, we haven't got anything precious to preserve anyhow. And I think this attitude and vision exist even within the architecture community, who might be seeing in other places, let's say in Western cities or like in Gulf state cities, as a model that should be followed, and who might, with good intentions, really cause serious harm to our social, cultural, and historic fabric of our cities and towns.
I wanted to just close with asking you about your own work in all of this. And, how do you translate your kind of research into practice? And how do you think about your place as someone who's been exiled in these conversations?
Yeah, it's such a great question that I'm asking it myself every day. I think it felt with the case in Syria that there were years that nothing has happened, and there were days that everything is happening. And that's the case in 2025, that literally after Syria becoming a forgotten forever war, that even Syrians were exhausted and not anymore, many of them were no longer working on it or not wanting to work on it because they are burnt out, they are tired, they no longer see hope. Now everyone again wants to work on it. Syrians who left the country and no longer work on Syria want to return and do something. And I'm seeing an explosion of initiatives and projects and people trying to register their companies or platforms or foundations. So we are in a time where there's a new wave of excitement, and within the architecture space, that's also the case. So every two or three architects who I know would contact me and say, like, oh, why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? I think it's a very good time, and I think it's a very important way to mobilize and organize. I'm a little bit afraid of turning Syria into a fragmented organizations instead of strengthening, empowering, and building the currently existing infrastructures and working on organizations that have been working in the country for decades. Of course, there's space for new projects, but I think there's also a space to empower the existing structures. And as much as I love what's happening in all these new initiatives, I feel what I'm telling my friends and colleagues that we all have to think about our own tools and devices. I cannot, as an academic, now go and design things if I haven't been designing buildings or projects. I cannot go and plan like Homs's strategy if I haven't been working on a strategy or something. And I think we need to be careful and selective at this moment, but also we need to find alliances and find the right partners to work with. When I went to Homs, even though people were struggling financially and living in extreme living conditions, but still there's a huge appetite for research, and there's also a huge appetite for turning this research into practice. So for me now, I'm in conversation with multiple Syrian friends and allies and Syria friends, not only Syrians, to think about what could be done. And this could be translating our research into practice through workshops, seminars, organizing conferences, working with local charities, trying to see how do we protect what remains of our cities through applying our theories and concepts in practice, and how can we really collect a trauma-informed and a community-led approach towards reconstruction? What is the role of the researcher there? I think we have a huge opportunity to contribute, and I don't think we should remain in a moment like a ruptured moment like we live today in Syria and in many countries. We shouldn't just take our academic hat only, but we really have to push different boundaries to see how can I talk to somebody who maybe does not have the time or the access to our academic papers? How can I translate my research into practice? What does it mean to create an archive that documents the voices of the people about their own visions of what the future looks like, instead of international organizations coming to tell them how their future should look like? So I think there are so many different opportunities, but it's all about being focused, finding the right partners, being selective, but also, more importantly, being on the ground. So for me, after more than 13 years of forced exile, I'm trying now to start dividing my time more between Oxford and Homs, and I'm trying to see on a personal level how can I do that, when I'm working in a UK academia. Can I go there every 3 4 months? Can I work there with different partners and organizations? How to conduct field work there, and where can I be useful? And how can we create spaces for dialogue, trust, and civic peace in a place where there has been so much misery and suffering and despair?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really important. I think that just kind of thinking about, how is this community led? How is this trauma informed? And it's very complex to sort of work through these conditions in which a civil war has ended and communities are have been divided because of the conflict. And how do you, use research and practice to bring people together and have them kind of share in the rebuilding of spaces? And I really hope that the work that you're planning, including dividing the time between here in the UK and Syria, goes really well. Thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your work with us.
Thank you, Romola, for having me.